You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Hey! What are you trying to do? You ruined my record, man! I just bought it!
Did you realize this year's Record Store Day is April 20th, also known as 420? We here at WORT are certainly aware, and as a matter of fact, we're throwing a party at the Crystal Corner Bar with two great local bands, Iftikhar and the Earthlings, supplemented by sets from WORT DJs, Julia McAnley from Her Infinite Variety, Brian Hirsch from Green Morning Radio, and Newphone Rick of XL290 Live Music Radio Hour. So we'll see you at the Crystal Corner, Saturday, April 20th, for a Record Store Day and 420 celebration with Iftikhar, the Earthlings, and WORT DJs.
Welcome to Worldview, your weekly source for news and analysis from around the world, right here on community-supported radio, WORT 89.9 FM.
Good evening, and welcome to the Sunday, April 7th edition of Worldview. I'm Lee Rowe, and I'm your host. Later in the program, we have special guests in the studio. Cassandra Dixon and Rowan Atala will be here to talk about Madison efforts to support Gazans in various ways, plans by our local organizations to support Gaza, and about Cassandra's upcoming travels by sea. But first, we have the news.
The United Nations began distributing food in Sudan's Darfur region on March 29th for the first time in months. The UN World Food Programme, the WFP, said two aid convoys crossed the border from Chad carrying food and nutrition assistance for about 250,000 people for a month. The deliveries followed lengthy negotiations to open humanitarian corridors from Chad. It was in April last year that fighting broke out between Sudanese military rivals and which is now causing one of the world's most worst hunger crises, with about a third of the population, or 18 million people, facing acute hunger. WFP Sudan Country Coordinator Eddie Rao said in a statement, quote, "I fear that we will see unprecedented levels of starvation and malnutrition sweep across Sudan this lean season," unquote, referring to the upcoming planting months. The UN warned in March that 222,000 children could die from malnutrition in the coming months unless their aid needs are urgently met. Despite this aid delivery, the WFP has been unable to schedule further convoys. Many in Darfur, particularly in displacement camps, say they have not received any aid since before the war. The UN's aid response for Sudan is only 5% funded.
Senegal's new president, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, was sworn in last Tuesday and named his colleague and mentor, Ousmane Sonko, as prime minister. Sonko unveiled the new 25-minister cabinet on Friday, hailing it as a break from the past and a systemic transformation voted for by the Senegalese people. He said the government's priorities would include employment for young people, lowering the cost of living, and protecting human rights. Faye campaigned on promises to clean up corruption and better manage Senegal's natural resources. His victory was seen as reflecting the will of young people frustrated with widespread unemployment, officially at 20%, and cleaning up corruption and cronyism. In his campaign, he also called for getting rid of the CFA franc, West Africa's common currency, but dropped that issue as a lesser priority given the seriousness of unemployment and the need to solve other governmental problems first. Faye and Sonko now face the challenge of bringing about a national reconciliation while easing the cost of living crisis and fighting corruption. Faye also promised to restore national sovereignty over key assets such as the oil, gas, and fishing sectors.
Former Prime Minister Imran Khan's jail sentence in a case related to illegal selling of state gifts was suspended by the Islamabad High Court last week. Khan and his wife were each given 14-year sentences in the case on January 31st, after Khan was accused of not disclosing the more than $500,000 sale of gifts he received as Prime Minister of Pakistan from 2019 to 2022. The case will be taken up by the High Court after the Eid holidays. Khan is the founder of the main opposition party, Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, or PTI, and has been in prison since August last year on several charges. The sentencing on the gift charges had made Khan ineligible to contest for public office for 10 years and also fined him and his wife $2.8 million each. That conviction occurred a day after Khan was handed a 10-year prison sentence for revealing state secrets. Khan and his wife were also convicted for 7 years when a court ruled on February 3rd that their 2018 marriage violated Islamic law. PTI politician Syed Zulfikar Bukhari, a close Khan aide, told Al Jazeera he was confident of a favorable outcome given the way the state gifts case was progressing in the court. He said, quote, "I have said this since the conviction that the cases against Khan and his wife do not have the legs to stand on, and it was only a matter of time before they would get thrown out. We welcome this decision, and hopefully this will be the outcome in all other cases against Khan and his wife, as they are all frivolous in nature," unquote.
South Koreans will vote for a new 300-member parliament next Wednesday. Like many Americans, the issues South Koreans care about the most are their livelihoods and other domestic topics, rather than nuclear threats and the U.S. security commitment. AP reports that experts say up to about 30-40% of South Korea's 44 million voters are politically neutral, and their votes will likely determine election results. Choi Jin, director of Seoul's Institute of Presidential Leadership, estimates that some 30% of South Koreans are strongly conservative, 30% are strongly liberals. He says these voters will likely vote according to their party affiliation. The remaining 40% are moderates who focus on issues such as prices, jobs, and taxes. And that's where public debates center at the moment. Prices of agricultural products during March increased by more than 20% from the same month last year. Prices of apples alone increased nearly 90%, the largest one-year jump since 1980. Another current issue is the strike by thousands of medical interns and residents protesting the conservative government's push to increase medical school admissions to train doctors to care for an aging population. Strikers say universities cannot handle the steep increase in students, while critics say doctors are concerned their incomes will suffer if there are more of them. Meanwhile, the media is following rhetoric of the rival parties that, fueled by contempt for the other side, spew highly offensive, abusive language against each other.
Deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon forest dropped in 2023, but rose in the Cerrado, the world's largest tropical savanna biome in Brazil. The Cerrado is also the most biodiverse biome and where 60% of Brazil's agricultural production takes place. The COP26 Climate Summit in 2021 allocated $240 million for projects that align increased agricultural productivity with environmental preservation in Brazil. Of the 11 projects funded by the initiative, 7 are in the Cerrado, which received 98% of the funds. Daniel Carriera, director of financial sector engagement at the Tropical Forest Alliance, said, quote, We see an important role not only from the financial sector, which is placing money on the table, but also from companies that depend on soybean and cattle farming in Brazil, who are helping the initiative, unquote. She added that the initiative's main objective is to place farmers on the sustainability agenda while also allowing them to increase their production.
Peruvian President Dina Boluarte has dodged another attempt to impeach her on corruption charges. Boluarte's home was raided last week as part of a continuing investigation related to her undisclosed luxury jewelry and Rolex watch collection. Lawmakers twice rejected motions on Thursday to bring her impeachment up for debate. The first was rejected on a 49-33 vote with 12 abstentions, and the second by an even wider margin of 59-32 with 11 abstentions. Congress had already rejected two prior motions to dismiss Boluarte. She was serving as vice president in December 2022 when her predecessor, Pedro Castillo, attempted to dissolve Congress. He was later impeached and arrested. Boluarte was immediately targeted by Castillo's supporters, who said the former president had been targeted by the legislature. Targeting and impeaching leaders is part of a larger trend in Peru, which has seen six presidents since 2018. The Peruvian constitution allows impeachment proceedings to be brought on a vague moral incapacity provision, which does not require proof of legal wrongdoing. Impeachment requires only 87 affirmative votes from the 130-member chamber.
The military spokesman for the Houthi forces, Yahya Saadeh, announced today that his forces struck two Israeli ships and a British ship in the Red and Arabian Seas with ballistic and winged missiles. Saadeh reiterated that the group's forces will continue to prevent Israeli navigation in the Red Sea until the Israeli aggression against the Palestinians stops and the siege on Gaza is lifted. In solidarity with Gaza, which is facing a devastating Israeli war with American support, the Houthis targeted Israeli-owned or connected cargo ships in the area. Since the beginning of this year, the U.S.-led Guardian of Prosperity Coalition has launched raids that it says target Houthi sites in various regions of Yemen. Due to U.S. and British involvement, the Houthi group announced that it now considers all American and British ships as among its military targets.
The home of Libyan Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dbeibah was attacked with rocket-propelled grenades today. There are, as of now, no reports of human casualties. Reports of strong explosions near the sea in an upscale Andalus neighborhood in Tripoli, where the Prime Minister's house is located, were followed by reports of security forces with armored vehicles rushing to the area. Libya has two conflicting governments that share power in the country, which has been in political and security crisis since 2011 when President Muammar Gaddafi was killed by a NATO-backed uprising. The National Unity Government, headed by Dbeibah, was installed through a UN-backed process in 2021, but Parliament in the East stopped recognizing its legitimacy at the end of that year after a failed attempt to hold general elections scheduled for December 2021. Dbeibah pledged not to cede power to a new government without holding general elections. And those are our headlines for today. Now here's Gil with our first longer story.
Indian elections for a five-year term will be held in seven phases between April 19th and June 1st, and votes will be counted on June 4th. According to an India TV-CNX opinion poll published on Wednesday, a coalition led by Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's party could win nearly three-fourths of the parliamentary seats, while the main opposition Congress could hit a record low. But opinion polls have a mixed record in the diverse country of 1.42 billion people. Still, the popular Modi can claim strong economic growth, handouts to favored groups, and the January inauguration of a Hindu temple on a contested site in the Hindu-majority country. Not in his favor is his poor job creation record and widening disparity between the rich and poor, and an unknown number who adhere to the idea of a multicultural, multi-religious society that's outlined in the India's constitution. Congress Party leader Rahul Gandhi said, "This fight is to save democracy and the Constitution," after filling his nomination papers. The party's India coalition partners have agreed to jointly contest the elections, but are struggling to stay united, and its leaders are facing multiple corruption charges that they say are politically motivated. Last Sunday, they united to protest against the arrest of a prominent leader weeks before the election, accusing Prime Minister Modi and his party of rigging the vote and harassing them with a variety of bogus legal charges. Delhi Chief Minister Arvind Kejriwal, a strong Modi critic, anti-corruption crusader, and high-profile leader of the 27-member India opposition bloc, was arrested on March 21st for alleged graft over granting liquor licenses. Kejriwal's Aam Aadmi Party says the case is fabricated and politically motivated. Modi's government and his Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, deny political interference and say law enforcement agencies are doing their job. Further, India is YouTube's largest market, with over 460 million users and many Indians getting their news from YouTube. Some of the most popular YouTube news channels in India are increasingly offering disinformation and Islamophobia, often cheerleading Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his party, while targeting its critics and opposition leaders. With these cards stacked against them, it appears the opposition has a steep uphill fight and that this year's polls may be correct. But India is always surprising.
A report from Human Rights Watch, or HRW, released on Wednesday says that Colombia and Panama are failing to effectively protect and assist migrants and asylum seekers crossing the Darien Gap, the region in the Isthmus of Panama that connects the continents in Central America. It consists of a large watershed, forest, and mountains in Panama and Colombia. The HRW findings resulted from visits to the area and interviewing migrants, asylum seekers, victims of serious abuses, aid workers, and authorities. They also conducted virtual interviews and reviewed various data reports. This is HRW's second in a series of reports on migration via the Darien Gap. HRW America's director, Juanita Gobertus, said, quote, "Whatever the reason for their journey, migrants and asylum seekers crossing the Darien Gap are entitled to basic safety and respect for their human rights along the way. Colombian and Panamanian authorities can and should do more to ensure the rights of migrants and asylum seekers crossing their countries, as well as of the local communities that have experienced years of neglect," unquote. HRW found that efforts to guarantee access to food, water, and essential health care services are inadequate on both sides of the border, and that migrants and local communities have long experienced marginalization, high poverty rates, and a lack of opportunities. HRW found that authorities are also failing to protect the right to life and physical integrity of migrants and asylum seekers, and have not investigated violations effectively, promptly, and thoroughly. Crimes against migrants, including cases of sexual violence, go uninvestigated by both Colombia and Panamanian authorities due to limited resources and personnel, and largely because of poor coordination between authorities of the two countries. In early March, Panama suspended the work of Doctors Without Borders, saying their contract ended in December, although the organization had been seeking contract renewal since October. The organization played a leading role in assisting migrants and asylum seekers, including hundreds of survivors of sexual violence. Since 2021, over 1,300 people have reported sexual violence to Doctors Without Borders, but the numbers are likely to be higher.
The Emir the Emir of Kuwait, Mishal al-Jabar al-Ahmed al-Sabah, today accepted the resignation of the government headed by Prime Minister Mohammed al-Salim al-Sabah, just 2 days after the National Assembly election results were announced. The Prime Minister and the ministers in his government were instructed to deal with, quote, urgent affairs until the new ministry is formed, unquote. The Emir called on the National Assembly to meet for the first regular session on April 17th. This is the first election during the rule of the Emir of the country, who assumed the reins of power last December. Kuwait is a constitutional monarchy or emirate, and tension in the relationship between the government and parliament has repeatedly led to the government submitting its resignation or being dismissed after repeated interrogations and representatives, in addition to the National Assembly being dissolved several times in recent history. 200 candidates, the lowest in 5 decades, competed in the fourth election since December 2020. 62% of the 3.1 million population voted. One woman out of 50 representatives won a seat in parliament. The elections are run on the one-vote system, where each voter has the right to cast a vote for only one candidate. Kuwait consists of 5 electoral districts. Each district has 10 representatives, and the top 10 selected from each district receive a seat in parliament. Last February, the Emir issued a decree dissolving the National Assembly, which was elected in June of 2023. In view of, quote, the National Assembly's transgression of constitutional principles by not showing respect for the Supreme Court, unquote. This relatively small country in the Middle East with high oil-based income is in the middle of a 25-year development plan to use renewable energy, lead regional finance and investment efforts, maintain one of the oldest sovereign wealth funds, and invest in space research and expand tourism industries.
After Iran eliminated doubt with certainty, confirming through many of its officials during the past few days that it would respond to Israel's bombing of its consulate in the Syrian capital, Damascus, and this would be painful if threatened again, it threatened again today. Iran's General Rahim Safavi announced that Israeli embassies are no longer safe, in reference to an Iranian retaliatory response to last week's Israeli bombing of Iran's consulate in Damascus last Monday. Safavi believed that new events will shape the future of the region, considering that the conflict in Gaza is reshaping the dynamics of global security, as he put it. In the latest Israeli attack, 7 members of the Revolutionary Guard were killed, including 2 top commanders and their deputies. The killing was described as the most painful for Iran since the United States assassination of Commander Qasem Soleimani in Baghdad in January 2020. Iran's response to the killing of Soleimani at the time was limited to launching some missiles toward an American base in the region. However, this response did not come until after Washington was informed of the matter, according to what was revealed months ago by former U.S. President Donald Trump. Bagheri, the chief of the General Staff of the Armed Forces, Major General Mohammed Bagheri, said, quote, "The retaliatory operation will be carried out at the appropriate time with planning and with maximum damage to the enemy, making them regret his action," unquote. He added, quote, "We are the ones who determine the time and plan of the operation," unquote. American officials suggested that Iran's threat targets were likely to be Israeli consulates and embassies in a number of countries. While the timing is still ambiguous, some American officials also suggested that it would take place before the end of the month of Ramadan, that is, within the next few days, according to the New York Times report. It is still unknown whether Iran's attack will be launched from Syria, Iraq, or preparations have been completed to respond to any scenario that may confront Iran. American officials confirmed that the United States and Israel are on high alert. And that's a wrap of news from around the world for Sunday, April 7th, 2024. I'm Lee Rowe.
And I'm Gil Halstead.
Sources we used to prepare today's stories were Agence France-Presse, Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, Anadolu, the Associated Press, the BBC, Deutsche Welle, AFA, France 24, The Guardian, Human Rights Watch, IRNA, Middle East Monitor, Mongabay, Reuters, and Sana.
Good evening and welcome to the Worldview feature for this Sunday. I'm Gil Halstead, I'm your host, and I'm joined in the studio today by Cassandra Dixon, who is with Rafa's sister city, and we'll be hearing more about an upcoming trip that she's going to be taking to Gaza. Our focus tonight is going to be on what is happening in Gaza and what will be happening over the next couple of weeks. Also joining me is Rowan Atala, who is actually the co-host of the show that follows us here on WORT, Salamat. And he is also the treasurer for Madison Rafa Sister City Project. So thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
I wanted to start, before we get into talking about, it's the Freedom Flotilla that we're going to be talking about, I think, the most tonight, about what's planned next week in terms of a massive effort to bring aid to Rafah in the midst of the war still going on. But I wanted to get a take from each of you right now about where you see things stand right now. I mean, we're all listening to the news as it's coming in and trying to keep track of it. But as we're talking about a flotilla of aid vessels heading in there, what do we know about what it's like on the ground right there, right now? I know you're not there, but we're all reading the news.
That's a really difficult. I mean, we don't really have a great snapshot, right? I mean, if anybody who is paying attention currently to the major media outlets, especially, is largely in the dark about the real situation there. I mean, we've, I think, tipped from a situation where the majority of the fatalities were caused by airstrikes or tank shells or gunfire, right? And we're moving into a phase now where the deliberate forced starvation of the populace is beginning to account for a larger and larger percentage of the deaths in the Gaza Strip. And even the really half-baked attempts so far by governmental agencies to get aid into the Strip have not been successful. It's nowhere near enough, or it's delivered, I mean, you know, the airdrops were killing people, right? And the number of trucks permitted through the Rafah crossing is a very small fraction of what it was before they began the assault. And the will of individual governments to actually do something to challenge the blockade or to halt the flow of arms to Israel just doesn't seem to be enough to move the needle as far as what the occupation is doing right now in Gaza.
And so, as you've said, the need for the aid is even more now for not necessarily for people who have been injured by the bombing or by the firing that's going on, but by the lack of just the total collapse of the whole system there that could provide food or medical support normally.
Right. And I think that there's another thing that maybe is not, you know, even before this round of assaults, right, limitations on aid into Gaza were already well below the 2,000 calorie per person per day mark, right? And this was a deliberate tactic adopted by the occupation. And I think the last estimate that I heard said that there is available now in Gaza something around 275 calories per person per day. And of course, the vast majority of that is not in the northern half of the Strip where the need is the most urgent.
And so, to address that situation, there's this effort underway right now that will be launched next week. The Freedom Flotilla Coalition, and I guess I'd like to ask each of you, Cassandra, maybe you could begin by talking about exactly what it is. It appears to be, from the reading I have done, kind of a repeat on a much larger scale of an effort that was made back in 2010, known as the Mare Marmara, that was also coming from Turkey and through Cyprus in the same way. And I have been reading about the results of that effort that actually led to the death of 10 people on one of the ships, the ship that was coming in, and the injuries of some Israeli soldiers who actually got on the boat and prevented it from arriving in Gaza. So give me your take, Cassandra. You're about to take off on this trip. You're going to Cyprus in a week. What's your understanding of how it's all organized and what's going to happen?
Right. Well, so this is a civilian initiative to bring aid from civilians to civilians, largely in response to the fact that aid is not getting in. So this would not be happening. The people that are working to plan this would not be doing so if aid was reaching hungry people in Gaza already. So this is a serious effort to bring serious aid in. It's multiple ships with thousands of tons of desperately needed aid. accompanied by civilians from a wide range of countries and media, people who definitely want to see this happen. And our great hope is that the ship will be allowed to dock and the aid will be unloaded and get immediately, like directly, to people who need it desperately. My own hope is also that in this moment, any moment, that the road access to Gaza will be opened, that the thousands of pounds and trucks and people and aid workers and that are trying to reach those hungry people only 10 minutes away will be allowed in.
This coalition, I've read an article recently that says that we'll be gathering in Turkey includes 1,000 boats. That's one of the estimates I've read in one of the reports here. And you're saying from lots of different countries here, I'm seeing 1,000 vessels would be 313 boats filled. Among them is one filled with Russian activists, 104 filled with Spanish activists, and 12 Turkish vessels that will join the flotilla. Does that sound
right.
accurate?
And so the U.S. boat to Gaza is one portion of the yes. Freedom Flotilla, and it is like, I think this is it's kind of indicative to how the world sees this, that a good portion of the world is horrified by the fact that aid is not reaching starving people, right? And yes, the U.S. definitely needs to be part of this because we're part of this situation.
And so you're going to be heading to Cyprus. The flotilla actually is beginning in Turkey. Are you going to Turkey?
I'm going to Turkey.
You are going right. to Turkey.
Yeah,
okay.
And I don't actually know that, you know, boats do not start and move and stop on
right.
a dime. And they are subject to weather and all kinds of
whether it's going to actually happen
things.
That day.
I mean,
yeah.
they are not airplanes. And yeah. so I don't know when exactly the boat will leave, but sometime in mid-April is our hope.
And it's going to be, how did this coalition come together? I guess that's one of the, I'm listing off here just what I know from this one news report that there are going to be Russian activists and Spanish activists, 313 votes, 104. How was this organized? Was there some sort of, this coalition have meetings somewhere over the past several months and figure it all out?
Yeah.
You don't know. It's okay.
Yeah. I have to admit that I don't find any of it amusing at all myself. I'm so appalled by the fact that children are starving 10 minutes away from aid that's sitting in a truck. And yes, it may be laughable to think that there are some Russians and some Spaniards and some people from the U.S. and from wherever else you want to list that think that they need to get to Gaza and fix this. But we do definitely, like we desperately need individuals from all the world's countries to demand an end to this and demand that our governments take responsibility for this. This shouldn't be the work of civilians. This shouldn't be the work of somebody who needs to, ask their friends to help pay the credit card bills for doing this. This shouldn't be happening this way.
No, absolutely not. And I think it's one of the things that a number of people in the press have pointed out, when we see the situation in Gaza, especially starvation, dehydration, and now, the spread of associated diseases, it's always written about in the U.S. press as almost in a passive voice, a famine has appeared in Gaza. Well, It's being caused, and it is being caused deliberately by the occupation and by the states that support the occupation, and chief among those, and increasingly isolated as the largest supporter, of course, is the U.S. And it is, I agree completely with Cassandra. It's utterly absurd that, we have to resort, people of conscience have to resort to attempting to run a blockade with civilian vessels in order to get aid into Gaza.
And that's due to the fact that Israel as an occupying power has resorted to using starvation as a weapon. So how can we be living, how can we in 2024 be world citizens in a situation where we would allow an occupying power to use starvation of children as a weapon against a populace? I don't have any words for this.
I understand. But the fact is that it is happening. It shouldn't be happening, but this flotilla has been organized,
and
people are going from all of these different countries.
Yes.
Right.
I'm just trying to get a better sense of how that was organized. I think that I understand, and I think most of our listeners probably understand why this has happened. Right. It's because what you've just listed off, that what should be happening isn't happening. So some people who are really morally conscious about this have organized this, and it is going to happen.
The Freedom Flotilla Coalition, which is made up of more than a dozen member countries, and U.S. boat to Gaza is the U.S. component of that, has sailed multiple boats, made multiple attempts to break the blockade
over
on
many
Gaza,
years,
over many
right.
years, right? Because as Rowan has pointed out, that this particular situation is unbelievable, but the measuring of the number of calories allowed per person in Gaza has been going on for a long time, and no populace can be expected to live under a complete air and sea blockade for generations. It's not possible to have an economy in that situation. It's not possible for businesses to function. It's not possible for education to function. It's not possible to bring a piano into the country, or to bring musical instruments for an orchestra, or to bring medical equipment. The list of things that Israel has curtailed and has prevented from being imported includes potato chips and tampons. It's not possible to live under these situations. And yet the world has been allowing this to go on and on and on and on for 50 years of this blockade. So the Freedom Flotilla Coalition has been attempting to bring that to light for many, many years. And this is, that's why that they were in a position to organize an aid flotilla at this time, because they have been organizing ships in the past. And so have every confidence that if they are able to land the aid, that it will be distributed well. They have connections with distribution sources within Gaza, with humanitarian sources inside Gaza to get that aid where it needs to go, if it can get in. And they have member groups in so many countries who want to see this change, who desperately want to see it change. Some of them, I think, with more understanding of their governments than we may be experiencing here right now. But throughout that list, it's civilians in those countries.
Yeah, and the parent organization that Cassandra mentioned, the Freedom Flotilla Coalition, is sort of a larger umbrella organization that incorporates a bunch of different nation-based initiatives. So, just for example, there's Canadian Boat to Gaza, Freedom Flotilla Italia, My Care Malaysia, Kia Ora Gaza, which is a New Zealand-based organization, Ship to Gaza Norway, Palestine Solidarity Alliance, Rumboa Gaza from Spain, Ship to Gaza Sweden, the Mavi Marmara Freedom and Solidarity Association, U.S. Boat to Gaza, International Committee for Breaking the Siege of Gaza. And those are just the ones that are actually organizing the flotillas from the individual countries. And then there's another, there's a whole roster of backing organizations which are providing additional support.
Some of which are probably international, representatives from lots of different countries. Well, but I think just returning to what was said before about why and how it is happening that that governments, our government in particular, the United States government in particular, haven't been doing what's necessary, and the United Nations that has been providing aid to Gaza over these many years is now being prevented. Their funding is being strangled. They can't do what they have been doing for all of these years. And maybe these are civilian organizations, not government organizations.
Right.
The government organizations aren't doing their job is the message I'm hearing from you guys, right?
I would say that is absolutely true. I mean, there's a handful, right, a handful that have now called for halting the flow of arms. Okay, so that is an important piece, and to be candid with you, I thought I was surprised. I didn't think that we were going to see that.
But the These are some European countries.
Yeah, the fact that that is happening, I think, really speaks to a turning of the tide in terms of international sentiment about Israel, and by extension, the U.S.
Well, I think I would be remiss not to focus again on the U.S. government and just mention that President Biden's going to be in Madison tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's unlikely he's going to be saying anything about this situation. But there, I think that there will be civilians here in this country, in this city, who want to hear that, and maybe they're demanding that we hear from him and respond to a call for a demand to change the current policy and move the dime.
You know, I would love to see that if I thought that there was actually going to be a good faith effort. Okay, but the $1.2 trillion spending bill that was approved in late March really kind of indicates that whatever comes out of that man's mouth is for the convenience of pacifying the electorate more than any real attempt to see a change on the ground in Gaza. The fact that they passed that bill that included not the full slate of foreign aid that they wanted, but an additional $3.8 billion to Israel, and in that same bill, cutting all funding to UNRWA for a year, okay? And I think it's also important that people know that Senator Baldwin voted in favor of this bill, as did Representative Pocan, right? So the people that we specifically in Madison look to for progressive leadership are doing nothing of the kind.
On the front of that front about the aid that has already been approved in the votes that you just described,
mm-hmm.
is President Biden, does he have the authority? Could he make an executive change? It's unlikely, but I'm just wondering if the way things work, he could, that the president could do something that would say, okay, stop sending the arms. We're not going to send any more from today. Does he have that power?
Well, I mean, technically in a legal sense, I'm sure it's open to challenge, but I think the Trump presidency illustrated that,
right.
You know, doing things by executive order and then waiting for the legal system to backdoor it is a fine way to actually get things done on the ground. And the simple fact that the president can, with a stroke of the pen, say, by executive order, that U.S. forces are going to be committed as long as it's not an official declaration of war,
right.
I don't see why he can't just pick up the phone and tell Mr. Netanyahu, you're done.
Mm-hmm.
I think that sending the message that arms funding to Israel was contingent on human rights, right? Like, we've never tried that. So Biden could certainly give that a try.
And, I mean, I thought that that was already actually one of the rules about how the United States extends aid. And we had someone from the State Department resign because that was not... That rule.
Well, we choose
was,
not to enforce that
right.
rule.
So, yeah, right, to
so
actually enforce
Biden
it.
Biden could send a message through whatever channels he wants, right? That's going to happen, right? I refuse to believe that he's powerless.
I'm kind of the same mind there. I believe that if he actually had a will to bring this thing to a sudden halt, I don't think it would be terribly difficult for him.
I also think that he has exactly as much power as we give him. So we as a populace, we have no business just waiting for Biden to do or not do something. We need to be loud. We need to make it absolutely clear that this is repugnant to us as a people, that this is not who we want to represent. Whatever our feelings about other issues in our country or how we like our electoral system or which party we belong to or we think we should have a third one or whatever that is, we don't have to sanction the intentional starving of children. We really don't have to. And we can make that loud enough and clear enough that it stands alone as this is an issue on which you are not supported by your populace.
So this aid that is going on these ships that are headed in the flotilla to get there, there is a way, other than speaking loud, an important thing for all of us to do, that listeners who are listening to us right now could do something just from their own pocketbooks to help make sure that that flotilla can make it there, can provide the funds and help people like you and others who are joining it actually pay their way to get over there and be part of bringing the aid there. So I thought I'd take this opportunity. We've still got about another 10 minutes left to chat, but I don't want to try to put it in at the end, okay? So if you would like to support the Gaza Freedom Flotilla Coalition, you can go to tinyurl.com, Cassandra to Gaza, or you can Venmo Cassandra at, is it me at CassandraDixon-11, or is it just at Cassandra Dixon?
It's at, I'm not looking at what you're looking at.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
At the bottom there.
I guess I would say that if you, probably the simplest thing is if you go to MadisonRaffa.org.
Okay.
And Madison Raffa has is working through Middle East Children's Alliance to raise aid money for Gaza. And we have an ongoing campaign to do that. And if you go to MadisonRaffa.org, it's easy to find a way to donate on there.
Okay. Just go right there and look for the donate button. That's what we say here when we're raising funds.
Yep.
So.
Yep. And I mean, so that's one path. There is also currently an active GoFundMe campaign, which I believe you can find on the Madison Raffa Facebook page. And or if you're not a Facebook user, you can also go directly to the Freedom Flotilla Coalition website, freedomflotilla.org.
I do have to, I wouldn't suggest donating to this GoFundMe campaign that I've launched right now, because GoFundMe is not releasing the money at this moment. So.
Oh, really? Well, that's a new one.
Yeah, that's that said here. We should have to try to follow up with that. But okay, so that we've told our listeners the best way to do it, which would be to go to the Raffa sister cities, because that's not connected with GoFundMe. It's going directly to the to efforts to bring aid to Gaza, right?
Yes.
Okay, good.
People are also welcome to come. Madison Raffa has an event coming up that would be a great chance for people to learn a little bit more, and it is also itself a fundraising event for Middle East Children's Alliance, and that's a commemoration of Rachel Corey. So Rachel Corey is a young woman who was killed while attempting to prevent the demolition of a Palestinian home in Gaza. So that event is the 14th from 1:30 to 3:30 at Christ Presbyterian Church.
1:30 to 3:30 there, and what's going to be happening there? It's a commemoration event for Rachel's.
Yes. So, this is something I don't think we did it. We did not run it every year, during the pandemic. But this has been a nearly annual event for many years. And so it's a relatively low-key event. There will be some very light refreshments. And there will be some music provided by Ensemble Shamali, which is a local trio that does Middle Eastern music. There are going to be some readings of poetry. There will be some, also a message from Rachel's parents, Craig and Cindy Corey. Whatever the most up-to-date news is, there will be some discussion of the current state of things on the ground, whatever that happens to look like, a week from now.
Yeah, we are all watching that. At least I find myself every morning turning on the news. I mean, we did hear this afternoon that Israel is apparently withdrawing some troops from Gaza, but it's not clear at all what that means. And they've been apparently are gradually withdrawing troops, but there's still active fighting going on. So
right, I think you also have to keep in mind that, yes, the troops their ground forces have been responsible for some of the worst atrocities against individuals and families and children, right? But they can still hit by tank, they can still hit by drone, they can still hit by air, you know, from the air, and they do. Or even, you know, right, offshore bombardment from the Navy. They can do all of that with while claiming that they don't have forces on the ground.
Right. Well, and they're just withdrawing them now. All those other things are still going on, and there doesn't seem to be an end in sight there. But I guess I'm trying to look for some hope in the situation, both in terms of a change in policy here, but the success of this of the flotilla. Actually, if it can actually get aid there to begin to roll back the threat of starvation that is rising there now, and if perhaps it can lead to a shaming, actually, of governments like the United States and others who are not allowing the aid in through normal channels.
I would hope. I would hope. I mean, I don't. There's plenty of shaming to be done
going on
already, and yet, our government and several other current and former colonial powers don't seem to be shamed.
Also, I think we absolutely have to stand up and name that Palestinians have a right to remain in their country. The solution to the incredible devastation of Gaza is not forced removal from Gaza. And so aid is a part of that, that we need to demand that enough aid be raised for people to remain there. And so if people do want the link to donate through Madison Rafa's page with Middle East Children's Alliance, it's tinyurl.com/Madison to Gaza. So if people are able to do that, it's a piece you can do.
Thank you, Cassandra Dixon, and thank you, Rowan Atala, for coming in to talk about this. And we wish you both the best, especially Cassandra, as she prepares to head off.
Thank you so
thank
much
you.
For having us.
Thanks for having
and
us.
And yes, thank you so much to Cassandra Dixon and Rowan Atala for telling us about opportunities to support Gaza and keep Gazans in Gaza. Nobody wants them to leave, especially they don't want to leave, so as bad as it is. For more information, you can go to madisonrafa.org, and Rafa is R-A-F-A-H. Just look around, look for their Facebook page. And also, if you're interested in the Middle East, we want to direct you to the UW-Madison Middle East Studies Program annual conference on Friday, next Friday, April 12th, in room 3312 in the Memorial Union. This year, the conference theme is Environment and Climate Change in the Middle East, and it's free and open to everybody. It features multiple academic experts across a variety of fields presenting new and cutting-edge work, and begins at 9 a.m. on Friday. There's more information on the Middle East Studies program pages on the UW-Madison website. And don't forget that the Waging Peace in Vietnam programs continue through the month with information at wagingpeace.com. So thank you to the Worldview Collective, especially Gil Halstead and Buya Jemme, Sabia Tia, Maria Brunetta, and to WORT News and Public Affairs Director Shali Pittman. And thank you for listening, and please join us next week for a new edition of Worldview here on your community-sponsored radio, WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org. And now stay tuned for Salamat.
Worldview is written and produced by a collective of volunteers. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can also contact us here at this station if you're interested in joining our collective to bring world issues to the airwaves. Worldview can be heard every Sunday from 5 to 6 p.m. on WORT 89.9 FM.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Overture Center for the Arts, presenting the Broadway show The Kite Runner, Friday, May 24th through Sunday, May 26th, in Overture's Capitol Theater. Beginning at a kite-flying tournament in Kabul, The Kite Runner spans two decades and two continents, revealing a journey of forgiveness and shows us all that we can be good again. More information and tickets are available at Overture.com.
In Arabic, we occasionally say